Hi everyone, this is Grant at Cause Artist. In episode 68 of the Investing in Impact podcast, I speak with Robert Keith, the founder and managing principal of Beartooth, on how environmental stewardship can be synonymous with financial gains. Robert holds a strong belief that the diverse financial tools and innovative growth slash exit strategies available to small business owners should also be accessible to ranch owners. With this vision, he co-founded Beartooth in 2005 to empower ranchers with these resources. In his role at Beartooth, Robert oversees all operations, with a particular emphasis on cultivating meaningful relationships in capital sourcing, investment structuring, and management. Before establishing Beartooth, Robert gained valuable experience at various financial institutions, including an agricultural investment company, a private equity firm, and Morgan Stanley. He holds a degree in economics from Yale University and a business degree from Stanford University. Despite his academic and professional pursuits, Robert consistently found himself drawn back to his family's ranch near Cody, Wyoming. Eventually, he made the decision to cease commuting to coastal regions for work and instead founded Beartooth to pursue his passion for supporting ranchers and their communities. Thank you for joining me on the Investing in Impact podcast. Until next time, stay humble, stay creative, and enjoy the episode.
Well, thank you so much, Robert, for joining me today. Really excited to talk about Beartooth. I don't venture off into the ranching world too much, so it's always awesome to chat about things that, you know, I don't know much about, and our listeners might be new to it as well. So before we sort of get into Beartooth, maybe the mission and vision, talk about your cool journey from, you know, ranching. I guess you have a family ranch in Wyoming, but you went off and did sort of traditional finance and you know, private equity, investment banking. So how did you make your way, you know, to ranching and starting Beartooth?
Thanks, Grant. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. You know, I don't know where my journey starts, but if one wants a formative phase, it's probably taking family vacations out to Jacksonville. Remember how old I was, probably 5 or 6. Just fell in love with the beauty, the wildlife, et cetera. But that was never going to be part of my work life, if you will. Put air quotes around my work in this context, because I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what that meant to work there. And I kind of had a vision of myself as an investor, maybe not at the age of 5 or 6, but shortly thereafter. And so I did the college thing in the East Coast and then worked for Morgan Stanley in New York City. It's really the dot-com boom and subsequent bust. So this is 2001 is kind of where the house came crumbling down. Went to business school on the West Coast then, and you know, I think really my journey, if you will, into the non-traditional path probably was seeded maybe with the ranch visits as a kid, but then really ultimately with my wife, and then with business school. And my wife's one of these amazing people who's always done good things for the world and worried about money later. And I have been just the opposite. Like, I need the most giant safety net blanket, you know, known to mankind, and then I'll worry about doing something good for the world. So that's a path I was headed down, but she kind of shocked me, and I think was an interesting creature almost because she was so different from me in that regard. But really, I went to business school, and you know, I took a couple classes. One was environmental entrepreneurship, and one was it's called corporate environmental management. And you know, this is 2001, so fair bit ago now. And the shocking thing to me is that there were actually case studies of companies, startup companies, larger corporations, et cetera, that were using the environment as an advantage. And I don't mean as like marketing, greenwashing kind of stuff, but they were actually finding ways to do a good thing for the world and then actually made the bottom line bigger or made the returns bigger. And so to me, that was like this aha moment that there didn't necessarily have to be a trade-off between financial returns and environmental benefit. And if you found the right niche, the right industry, the right product, the right whatever, you could have your cake and eat it too, if you will. You could have the wonderful financial returns and the great environmental outcome. And in fact, the coolest business models I saw, it was doing the right thing environmentally that drove the financial outcomes. And so that's really where this whole concept of Beartooth started from, is could we create something? You did the right environmental thing, and that's what drove your financial returns.
So when people ask you like what Beartooth is and sort of its mission and vision, how do you, you know, because you guys are doing a bunch of different things. So how do you sort of sum it up to people outside your sort of ecosystem?
Nice use of the word ecosystem. That's right. It's double entendre in this case. You know, it's easiest to think about it in two ways. And so at the start of Beartooth, we kind of said, all right, conservation groups, meaning Chota Limited, Nature Conservancy, local land trusts, et cetera. let's all agree, and I'm sure we can, that there's just not enough money going to your work. There's not enough money going towards restoring degraded river systems, towards cleaning up wetlands, cleaning up old mining sites, all that kind of stuff. There's just not enough. We can agree on that. So what if we could find more money? Not recycle other money that, say, came from a donor that one environmental group or another is going to get, but instead create a whole new source of money coming into this restoration and protection world. So that's kind of one piece of it. The other piece of it is to investors, where we really started this conversation, which is, hey, if you could have a solid risk-adjusted financial return, in this case, investing in real estate, and that did a good thing for the world, like, how exciting is that? Because those options, again, were really, really limited. In fact, they were mostly kind of swing for the fences venture type funds, because they were really focused on early stage technology, whether it be hydrogen or thin film solar photovoltaics or things like that. And then a little bit on the other end of the spectrum, like financing solar projects, maybe through project finance, that kind of thing. But there wasn't a lot in the wide open, I'd say, real estate field. And there wasn't a lot that kind of, in my mind, was this really crystal clear, really tangible thing that was, here's a broken creek. Here's a wetland that's been drained. Literally a creek, say, that's been put in a ditch. We're going to pull that thing out. We're going to put it back in its natural path that winds in a sinuous, sine wave type of thing. We're going to plant a bunch of trees. We're going to plant a bunch of naturally occurring grasses, and it's going to grow back. And you know what? It's going to be worth more than it was before. Why is it worth more than it was before? Because our economy really in the ecosystem, the markets we work in, has shifted from being extractive. And whether that be extractive in the sense of mining, of course, or cattle ranching. And cattle ranching, by the way, can be done in a way that's non-extractive. I strongly believe that. But historically, sometimes it was done in a less than good way, let's say, for the land itself. That's shifted. And really, the value now is no longer for, in the types of properties we look at least, surrounding Yellowstone National Park, the value is not in how many cattle can I run or can I find gold here. Instead, it's, I want to be able to fish in a beautiful creek with my kids. I want to be able to see elk, trotting through my pasture. I want to be able to build a home with a gorgeous, gorgeous view of that mountain range. Like, that is now the value. And so I guess there are certainly people far ahead of us, but really that long-term trend is what we kind of hitched onto, which is this shift away from extractive type of valuation to a more, what I'm going to call recreation, more emotionally, more environmentally appreciative type of value, where the more wildlife you have. So here's a great way to think about it. The more wildlife you have, if you're a rancher trying to grow alfalfa, the worse off you are because they're eating all your hay. They're literally eating your livelihood that you're going to feed to your cattle that winter.
Gotcha.
Whereas the wealthy New York City investment banker, the family out of California, the folks from Chicago who want the beautiful getaway that overlooks a river system, right? Those types of people, they want those animals there. And so, again, we're really managing and optimizing these properties for the long-term benefit of the land and the wildlife. And that is precisely who the buyer is in today's world.
So maybe the things that generate revenue are a little bit different.
Correct.
Gotcha. So, just ranch owners, in general, your region where Beartooth sort of primarily works, what are some of sort of the challenges that they sort of face? And, when you started, were you aware of these challenges that they have, or was there a lot of learning that you had to go through?
So, hitting on your secondary question in there, there's a lot we didn't know when we started ranch. I literally spent the first handful of years in ex-partner used to joke, he'd say, we're paying tuition. We're paying tuition. We didn't know that. We're learning that now. So there's a ton we didn't know. And your question on the rancher component, I think the biggest issue right now that we see, and we've been seeing it for many years, but is it's big food. And there's barely room for the family ranch operator at this point. And really because big food controls so much, so vertically integrated that they can demand effectively or command the market. And really, unless a rancher today has a unique and probably direct sales model to consumers for organic, grass-fed, beef, it's really hard to charge a premium. So with that direct sales channel, one can charge somewhat of a premium. And yet, truly, is that a premium compared to the actual value of the beef one might buy at McDonald's or Burger King? Probably not. Frankly, that stuff should be, if you captured all of the extrinsic and all the externalities, I should say, that that beef has on the world. Probably it's a screaming buy to buy directly from the rancher. Anyways, there's that challenge of really hard for small-time ranchers to make it. It's really hard to have scale and sell direct, of course. And so ultimately, it's a tough, tough business to be. And so that's really what we run into. It's just a really tough business to operate in. And it's tough because it's really hard to expand. Land costs a lot more than it used to, and mortgages are expensive, and it's challenging to find the mortgage rate that allows you to slowly pay off that acquisition. And so really, the ranchers are part of the world that thrive today are probably multi-generation, and or their family passed on in a way where they own it free and clear, and they're really good operators. And so most of the ranch operators we come in contact are pretty darn thoughtful because they are managing for the long run, and they are trying to make a go of this thing that's just so darn hard. So there is that. You know, I think that another trend that is worth mentioning is that the kids of those ranchers, I forget the precise statistic, Grant, but the average rancher is something like 65 years old in part of the world.
Right.
I think it puts error bars around my 65, but it's in that range. And really, that range is relevant because you're pulling cattle in sub-zero weather in February. And is that really what you want to be doing at that age? Do your kids want to be doing that at that age?
Yeah.
When they're your age?
It's
a really hard life. It's you do it because you love the land and you love the wildlife and you love being out there. So the challenge with that and the reason that I bring kind of the image of the cold February winter and everything is because a lot of those folks are deciding to retire and their kids are saying, I don't really want to be part of that. And so the kids are moving to San Francisco or Denver or wherever it may be. And the parents are saying, I got one retirement savings account. And it's called my land.
Yep.
And so one of the things we are trying to do as Beartooth is really work with that. And so what does that mean? It means that we're a very odd partner buyer in that usually the first thing we're trying to do is sit down with that ranch owner and say, what do you want? And it could be, I just want to get out, move to Arizona and put as much money as I can in the pocket. Great. Can't fault you for that. But there's a lot of them who say, I would love to have a home in the back 40 where I can continue to come back to after winter in Arizona. And I want my kids to be able to come visit this part of the ranch. So I'd like to hold on to that. Or, I want to sell in 5 years, not today. All sorts of creative ideas that come up with if they're asked. And so that's really where we've tried to put ourselves in this marketplace is being the type of buyer, the type of partner that sits down and asks a lot of questions. Tries to optimize, like I said, I used the word earlier, but to optimize not just the land, but to optimize the outcome for that rancher.
I know that every situation will be incredibly different. But when you, I guess this question maybe we'll do in kind of stages. One will be maybe a case study that you can maybe walk us through that kind of helps us really pixelate sort of the process.
Yeah, you bet. Case studies are dangerous because it's hard. I would typically think that one wants to generalize from them. In our little world, it's hard to generalize. Having said that, with that caveat, ranchers who found themselves behind on some debt payments and they were being threatened with foreclosure, and that would result in an auction type of scenario where they would end up with a disorderly sale and really a sale in which they wouldn't get to keep the piece of the ranch they most wanted to keep. And so they found themselves with their back against the wall, asked for some help. We came in and helped, and effectively we paid off all of their outstanding debt and said, okay, now what's your plan for what you want to have happen? And ultimately it was to slowly sell off the larger ranch after they did some optimization along the way for wildlife, for protection of this part of that part, restoration of this part of that part, et cetera. And then ultimately resulting in their keeping the piece that they valued most highly. Just this gorgeous piece connects the national forest, gorgeous. And so in this one that I'm describing, we're in process on it, but we got them the funds to be free and clear of that debt. And then we stepped back and said, all right, you guys run the show here for a number of years, and we'll be here if you want some thoughts, advice on how to work together and achieve that outcome you want, but otherwise you're in charge. So that's the kind of tee up for your question. I think we worked on a deal in Wyoming, Grant, where there were 9 different owners of this shared property. And these folks decided that they wanted to sell it. Their ranch manager is just a gem, and she actually came to us and said, they're going to sell at some point in time. I don't know when, I don't know how, but I think there's a lot of work that could be done to make this place more valuable from an environmental standpoint, which of course will make it more valuable from a financial standpoint. You seem like the right partner to partner with to do it. So we actually came in and with the ranch manager. I don't know that a ranch manager's ever been granted equity in an investment in his or her lifetimes, but we did that. Gave her a vested interest and an equity investment in this, buying this ranch from the sellers. I almost forgot my funny stories along the way. But so during due diligence here, Grant, we get a call from the ranch manager who says, hey, we got a challenge on this thing and I was just about to call you guys, et cetera. We said, well, what's going on? And she says, well, I was going to speak with a lawyer, but before I did, I want to tell you because the exterminator is also the paralegal in town and and the night job is the lawyer, the exterminator is a day job. And by the way, I was calling them because I remembered that the whole deed transfer thing went down in a strange way because that's the house that the guy used to have the prostitutes come to. I was like, oh my gosh, we got prostitutes, we got exterminators, we got all sorts of crazy stuff going on. So anyways, to make that deal complete, we ended up buying it with the ranch manager. We did 9 miles of creek restoration work. This is the drainage south of Jackson, Wyoming, and about 1,000 acres, of wetland restoration work. And the cool thing about that, Grant, is what we did is the science behind it, literally, in which we partnered with Trout Unlimited and the state of Wyoming and local conservation district, the science was effectively to act as beavers. And by that, I mean, beavers have been trapped out of this area century plus ago. So it's actually almost ground zero for beaver trapping. And so what you would do is create faux beaver dams. And that acts as a check on the water as it comes downstream, raising the water table and spreading it out across the ground, which then creates far more, much higher water table and more plant roots and different types of plants that are able to access it. So we had a big wetland impact, huge creek restoration for Colorado cutthroat trout, and eventually ended up selling it to some individuals who love fly fish.
Yeah, I mean, listen, anytime 9 people are involved in the ownership of a property, I mean, chaos will ensue in many different levels. There's just no way around that. The human element to all this and all these deals is probably incredibly active and nuanced in a lot of ways. The other question on top of that, you kind of mentioned these keywords is, restoration, ecological benefits, and sort of bringing the land, I guess, back to life, for lack of a better way to say it. It's hard to generalize, but I guess how much restoration, does every project need to have some sort of restorative aspect to it? Does it need to be brought back to sort of natural ecological, ecosystem that it should be in? Is that in every case the restoration process sort of has to be done?
For us, yes. Meaning we could do a lot of ranch flipping, house flipping, whatever kind of deals, but that's not why we exist. I think early on you asked about mission, vision, et cetera. And really our mission is to bring a new source of capital to restoration and protection of the most critical spots in the American West. And so if it's not a really critical property, there's kind of no point in us spending time. Somebody else could do that. Maybe they make a pile of money. I don't know. It's not relevant to us, really. Our niche is the ecologically important and impaired types of properties. And really, why? Because that's, from a financial standpoint, that's where the greatest opportunity is. If you can attack a property, we did one in Colorado that had been gold mined. And so, to your kind of rancher case study-ish type question again, you had a family that had owned this place for about 100 years. Just prior to their ownership, it had been gold mined, and in this case, placer mined. So literally, you'd taken machinery down the middle of the creek, scooped up chunks of the bottom of the creek, dumped them down the side, run some nasty chemicals through it, trying to sift out gold. And this family had owned it since, and they really didn't care all that much because they never wanted to sell it. To them, it's just the way it had always been. They could run their cattle, no big deal, but they went to sell it. And they ran into the buyer I described earlier on in this call, which said, what? There may be hazardous chemicals on this place. There's at least these giant 16-foot tall tailing piles of who knows what. It kind of looks like trash. We're just either not going to pay for it, we're not interested at all, or we're going to pay just a, pittance. And so we were able to work with those folks to come in and say, hey, look, we can see through this. And we'll clean it up. And so we worked in the state of Colorado, a whole bunch of other agencies to eventually clean all that up, clean bill of health, and create a wildlife management area open to the public for public access and sell a different part of the ranch to a rancher-run cattle, and then actually a third part to a wealthy family.
I want to kind of ask one question that is very odd to this, and I guess in your dealings with mining and dealing with sort of land and dealing with, you know, for lack of a better term, like the technology that we now have that can just do things better when restoring land, you know, when building houses, when doing all this, is there a way or anything that you've seen where properly mining is possible, whether it's more ecological, more, you know, sustainable in the aspect that you just don't have to do things as like dirty or violent to the land as you would before? Have you seen anything like that? That
I have not from a mining perspective, but that, you know, I'm not educated on the mining question. I mean, I think if I could send that question down a slightly different path, let's take timber, for example, or even grazing for that matter. We have done sustainable timber operations on this. And, you know, what makes it sustainable? The fact that we're starting with an absolute monoculture of trees. And so you really want a diverse set of species that's beneficial for wildlife, beneficial for carbon sequestration, beneficial for a whole lot of reasons. And so we've done a sustainable logging operation. We've certainly done sustainable grazing as well. And so I try not to ever paint anything as 100% bad or 100% good. Having said that, from a mining perspective, I again, don't know enough or haven't seen enough to be able to say I've ever seen it done in a way that I think is worth it.
I'll end on a couple questions here. One would be, I guess, what has it been like from, you know, talking to investors? What has their response been like? I guess, is it hard to, it's sort of a new vehicle, I guess, right? This is kind of something that hasn't necessarily existed before in a few different ways. But I guess the opportunity to be able as an investor to like invest in something like a little bit more beneficial in a lot of different ways. What's the response been from like them as far as, you know, having new ways to you know, allocate capital that's sort of beneficial to the land and possibly even their community, right? If the investors are, you know, located regionally, there's a lot of benefits to restoring the land and, you know, obviously getting return for that. It's kind of a new way, you know, to make money, right? It's an interesting path that I think hopefully we continue to go on. But
very much depends who I'm talking to, Grant. And I hate to kind of pamby-pamby about a response. But, you know, if we're talking to someone who owns a place near Bozeman or Jackson, Wyoming, and, you know, they get the drill, they know what a ranch is, they love to fish, they love to hike, they love the area. Like, for them, it's like, oh, geez,
no, Grant.
You ever existed, but I understand how you make money. I understand you're making the world a better place. Like, it could be more. You know, when we get folks that are not that familiar with it, really try to go bigger scale, bigger perspective, you know, 30, 50,000 foot view. Because, I mean, ultimately what we're doing is we're operating an investment vehicle, and that investment vehicle is sequestering carbon. It is providing habitat that is, I'm going to say, less vulnerable to a changing climate, i.e. restoring wetlands and things like that. We're providing time in those habitats for species to adapt to a changing climate. We're limiting the, you know, massive onrushes of water downstream from big runoff and storm types of events due to the type of restoration we're doing. So there's a big like climate change impact that's really tangible to the work we're doing, meaning it's not avoiding it's not an offset, you know, it's not avoiding an emission or trading an emission. It's like, back to your investor point, like an investor comes out and sees a restored wetland. If we're lucky, they've seen the before, they've seen the after, they see the creek that's, you know, put back in its natural path. It's like, blows their mind. And I think that's partly just the magic of real estate. Like, you literally can touch it. And yep. I also think there's this deep emotional piece of all of us that water matters, land matters. You know, you want to have that, you know, deep in our DNA somewhere. You want to have that security, that access to water, that, you know, kind of back against the trees, just, you know, the gorgeous land ethic, I think, that so many people have. And frankly, a lot of them don't know they have it. And they discover it. So, I hope I don't get any calls from investors after this, but I feel like one thing we've done is we've been somewhat informational for some of them, meaning for those that weren't very tied to the Western US or tied to the land.
Sure. Yeah.
And man, if they come out and see one of our properties and stand on that bridge where they can see the before and the after and things like that, like it is, it's a huge deal. And some of them start making donations to conservation groups. Some of them start thinking about buying their own place. It's just, it kind of awakens a spirit in them that maybe they didn't know existed.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like investor retreats, like from people outside the region, outside the region that doesn't have like, just come here for a weekend and you tell, you know, like you don't have to pitch anything, right? It's just the landscapes and
it does the talking for itself, Grant.
Yeah, exactly. Other question I had was around B Corp. You're probably, I mean, I don't know how many real estate sort of or financial firms are sort of B Corp, you know, certified, but what was sort of that process like for you being maybe an untraditional, you know, type of company or type of product? How was it, you know, talking with them, going through that process, maybe even, you know, educating, you know, maybe their team a little bit on a lot of the stuff that you're trying to do? Was that process, you know, tougher than you thought it would be? You know, what was that like for people thinking about and other companies and founders maybe thinking about going down that path?
I think the B Corp thing is wonderful. I think there should be more companies that are really seriously contemplating, at the very least, you know, how to minimize their harm, hopefully at the very best, how to make the world a better place. We should all be thinking that. We're all members of the same planet, the same tribes, you know, everything. So no brainer. It's challenging for us, and I think as you alluded to, because we're so different. And I'll even set B Corp aside, but just kind of speak to general like impact metrics and things like that. We're a different beast. And so a couple of years ago, did a little analysis on how much time we were spending on answering questionnaires from different impact investors, you know, different advisors to impact investors, the B Corps of the world, and others. And it was a lot. And it was enough where it meant that, you know, we were losing horsepower on the ground. We were having people's time get sucked away. And so I this is where my controversial stuff comes in. I kind of said, you know what, we're just going to do a good thing. And if anybody cares, wonderful. If they score us highly, they score us highly. If they don't, they don't. Yep. But it's an old adage of, what is it? It's honesty or integrity is what you do when no one's looking.
Yep.
Do you do that? That's something I harp on with my kids a whole lot. But we just basically say, you know what? Nobody's looking. We're not going to worry about if anybody's looking or not. We're not going to try to bend to their metrics. We're going to do it our way, do it ourselves. And you know, our business is so... Like our business doesn't exist if we're not doing a good thing for the world. And right. here's a comment for you that might be useful. You know, how do investors gauge our conservation success? Well, early on I said, call the conservation groups we work with. We did a deal with Nature Conservancy, call TNC, say what they had to say about it. We do a deal with China Limited, call them, ask them what they think about our work. You know, and the moment they say, man, Beartooth just really flubbed this one and they two-faced or whatever they say that's negative, like that investor goes somewhere else. You know, you're only as good as your word in this business, and in our little world's pretty darn small, so try to operate with that most too.
When I talked to a couple of founders who went down that path, you know, they were doing, I mean, really incredible work, you know, creating jobs, you know, manufacturing the right way, you know, selling a great product, giving back, you know, sales, you know, giving back margin. I mean, literally just a great business model. And, you know, when they went out to like invest, impact investors, let's, you know, say, and, you know, not necessarily B Corp, but organizations similar, right? They just kept on. It was just like, at some point, it's just like, what are we doing? What are we trying to dig deeper in? Like, look at what we're doing. It's pretty simple, right? It wasn't even that totally different. They weren't changing anything. They were just doing something that has been done before, but in a much more positive way. And I was like, how is that an issue? You know, I'm like, how is that, you know, such a problem to get some sort of, you know, verification for it? And like you said, they didn't necessarily need it, you know, because they were just like, man, we know what we're doing in our heart of hearts.
Right.
But it was the same way. It kept pulling them away from the business. It kept actually pulling them away from the impact that they were doing on the ground. And they had some frustrations. And I heard a couple of that from, you know, from some other founders and stuff like that. And so I just try to focus and spotlight people who are doing cool stuff on the ground day to day, you know, building something that's hard to do.
I think what you're highlighting, which I think is the right answer, is if pursuing the B Corp certificate or one of those, you know, ranking type systems brings you to do more good for the world, fantastic. It's exactly what it's supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
If it actually is sucking you away in a sense, because it's sucking away your time, you know, that's not so good. So we kind of got to figure out how to do that. Now,
Yeah.
We don't deserve a free pass. Nobody deserves a free pass. But I used to have fun because I would say, you know what, I'm going to create our own like set of impact metrics and share them with you. And at first it kind of started as a joke because it was like, how many other firms are you talking to that are gauging themselves by number of miles of wildlife unfriendly fencing removed? Probably none, right? I can tell you an amazing story about how we bought a ranch just north of Yellowstone National Park, and it had this 9-foot tall impenetrable fence on it. And so when we bought this place on the non-Yellowstone National Park side of the fence, we'd only ever seen 3 elk. Take down the fence, impact metric score, take down 2-3 miles of it, whatever it was, 30 elk the next year. Year after that, 300.
Wow.
Like, how do you score that? You just don't. Or number of beaver dam analogs installed. Example.
But yours is an unusual metric, too, is because how can you, have a metric for somebody visually being moved by nature, right? A beautiful scene like that just, you can't quantify that in some emotions that a human can have. And so, listen, I'm all for metrics. I think we all are, right? No doubt about it. It's an obvious thing.
Right.
But some things like can't be quantified, and we should not be sort of like marked for that in a negative way or something. Or there's added value to all of this, right? I mean, biodiversity is all about value add. There's these intangibles that we kind of can't measure. It's weird. Anyway, last question I'll have is just a little bit about the future. I know it's tough to, especially in this space, right? Markets change all the time. But maybe 3 to 5 years down the line, what do you and the team hope to sort of achieve and some of the goals that you'd like to get to?
I think we're at a really important time right now. And I know everybody feels that way historically speaking, but it's hard not to think that right now. COVID has fundamentally changed our marketplace, meaning the dollar volume of buyers of ranch properties is roughly double what it was pre-COVID at this point in time. So whether it could be COVID, the Yellowstone TV show, people just feeling less safe in an inner city environment, whatever it is, it's a whole bunch of factors. But if you go kind of 2019 to today, basically our market's doubled in size, number of buyers. But that's the demand side. We operate in a market that has a limited supply. In fact, not only is it limited, but it's declining. Limited because, of course, it's land. You are not making more of it. And it's declining because some of it's getting transferred to the federal government for protection. So you literally can't buy it anymore. It's literally getting taken out of circulation. Some of it's ending up in the hands of conservation groups. And, others of it's getting chopped up by developers. And so if you say, hey, I want a 1,000-acre ranch, like, nope, not anymore. That 1,000-acre ranch is now 500 acres and then 50 different home sites. And so to your question of what's going on in the next 3 to 5 years, we've got this, what now appears to be a structural shift, a long-term increase in the number of buyers looking to own properties with elbow room, beautiful views, open space, et cetera, particularly around Yellowstone National Park where we operate. So long-term structural demand shift. And yet that same demand, of course, has driven this shrinking supply and is fueling it at an even faster rate than before. At the same time, then, if you want to overlap on some of our impact stuff or our more environmental components, we got climate change going on. And the habitats that used to be appropriate for wildlife is shifting. So those wildlife need to be able to shift. And so for every development that goes in that has a home, a garage, a barn, a fence, it's throwing that wildlife off. So I really think that we as conservationists, we as Beartooth operating in this market, this part of the world, we got 5 or 10 years here to do our work. And really do a lot of it and do it really, really well. Otherwise, the phrase of loving a place to death, we're slowly loving the greater Yellowstone area to death. And so we happen to be one solution, an investment-related private type of solution for interesting projects in the neck of the world. Our conservation partners that we rely on for deal flow, for restoration funding, for sometimes helping find buyers, technical know-how, all that good stuff. They're also fighting that good fight, frankly, on the front lines every day to work on the science of how to restore creeks, to work on the advocacy associated with protecting certain areas, et cetera. So big picture, that's kind of what's going on in our world, our landscape for the next few years. And so for us as a firm, really our goal is to find those amazing opportunities and do more of them. And one of the things, Grant, that your audience might find interesting is we're encountering more and more investors. And I'm putting air quotes around investors, so I think that's important. They're investors, and as they've either gotten to know this part of the world more, whether they've ridden along with us for a few years, gotten more of this land ethic, like you and I talked about earlier, you know, their required financial return for restoring and protecting land has come down. So we have our market rate fund vehicle, which, you know, day in and day out, we're trying to hit market rate returns, risk-adjusted market rate returns. And yet we have had a number of these folks approach us and kind of set up almost a separate account style vehicle in which they say, I really care about grizzly habitat. And so when you have that opportunity that pops across your screen, this has happened a number of times now, Grant, where a conservation group reaches out and says, we can't move quickly enough on this project. It's going to get developed or otherwise we're going to lose our opportunity here to protect a really important piece just west of Yellowstone National Park. Can you help? We're able to go to those investors and say, okay, you talked about grizzly habitat. You know, you talked about antelope habitat. This thing's got water on it, et cetera, et cetera. Does this fit your criteria? Because I'll tell you what. I can't see a path to underwrite it at a market rate return. I can see a path to underwriting it where you get your money back, but that's it. And so what I think is really cool and really wise, if you will, forward-looking, we should all be grateful for, is a number of these people are saying, that's great. The financial return is only a piece of the return. Don't forget that the return is knowing that this place will forever be protected for grizz to move back and forth out of the west side of Yellowstone. That it's a protected wetland now, and thus amphibians and the bird life that goes with it has a place to adapt to a changing climate. You know, the trout have a really critical tributary stream to spawn in that's still cold as compared to the main stem of the river. And so all these other types of return, and you call it what you will, ecological return, emotional return, psychological return, whatever. But those things matter to a growing number of people. And to me, that's just it's an amazing and a beautiful thing, because that's really what we need is a greater appreciation of all this, because the standard sale to someone who wants to put a home there really isn't capturing that value to all of us and all of our offspring going forward. There's more there, and these people are seeing it. So I just couldn't be more grateful for our investors, really.
No, that's amazing to hear. I mean, I hear it more and more, but I think land and real estate is so unique because, like you said, we could see it, we could feel it. We can create memories with it and on it. Like, that is such a unique asset. And like you said, it's limited supply and they don't make no more. So such an interesting space, Robert. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know we went on a lot of different parts here and so grateful for your time. I just want to say best of luck for you and the team for the next decade to come.
Grant, thank you for your time. Thanks for all that you do. I sure appreciate it.